BBSR Businesses.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Where Women Work and Why It Matters. That's the title of a new report that has been just released by a trio of Vermont organizations, the Vermont Women's Fund, the Vermont Commission on Women, Vermont Works for Women, and Change the Story Vermont. Okay, that's a quartet of groups. It is the second in a series of papers or briefs that's being published this year related to women's economic status. The first, Women Work and Wages in Vermont, was released in January. Some of this data contained in these reports is pretty surprising, even shocking. 43% of women who work full-time do not make enough to cover basic living expenses, as defined by the Vermont Joint Fiscal Office. Well, here to talk about this report, why it came about, and what its implications are, we have Tiffany Bloomley, Director of Change the Story Vermont, and Mary Beth Redmond, Director of Development and Communications at Vermont Works for Women. Thanks, both of you, for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tiffany, let's start with you. What was the impetus? First, tell us about Change the Story Vermont. What is it?
Sure. Well, one of the things I try to make clear is that Change the Story isn't an organization. It's an initiative. It's a project, essentially. And it serves as a connective tissue. That's a pretty inelegant analogy, but among these three organizations that you mentioned, but also to other partners in Vermont who are working on a variety of things and who reach women and girls in some way. So Change the Story is aimed at systemic broader change because, as I said last night at the Women's Fund event, a baby girl is born today. She'll be 32 years old before we've closed the wage gap. Change the Story is asserting we can do better than this. And while we've made progress and closed the wage gap, it's actually that has slowed significantly in the last 20 years. And the wage gap is caused by a lot of different things, all of which I think can be addressed. It's not rocket science. But it does take collective will, and it takes more than just individual organizations serving women and girls to change it. It's really got to be systemic. So Change the Story is about trying to help catalyze that change, strengthen the organizations that are doing the work, carrying the water in working with women and girls, but also bring in new partners who really can make a difference.
Listeners who want to join in this conversation can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Tiffany, the name, Change the Story, how did you come upon that? What's the significance of that?
Well, I think we looked at about 100 different names, and we wanted it to be a call to action. Because this isn't an organization, it's a campaign essentially, and the story, the work that we had done at Vermont Works for Women in publishing Enough Said, a report on women and girls, girls mostly, about how they were thinking about work and education, their options, etc. That was based on a lot of stories that we were told in focus groups across the state. And what they told us was really concerning. We published that report. It led to a task force. It led to a series of recommendations. And it essentially morphed into what's become Change the Story. We want to change the story that girls tell us. So that an 11-year-old right now, by the time she's 21 and comes of age, she walks into a different world in terms of work, in terms of access to different kinds of educational options, and in terms of what is expected of her as a woman who might have children. So our Change the Story is about trying to change our societal expectations. I don't know, Mary Beth, do you have a different...
No, I often like to say Change the Story is an initiative to fast-track
women's economic security in Vermont. So so it's taking philanthropy through the Vermont Women's Fund, policy change through the Vermont Commission on Women, and programmatic offerings in the community through Vermont Works for Women in order to leverage our resources and have an exponential impact, and inviting all of these other partners. You know, one of the most exciting developments that has come out of this recently is Vermont Technical College, for example. They have put their stake in the ground. Dan Smith, the president there, has said in the next 3 years, we will try to raise our female enrollment in 5 STEM courses of study to 25%, tripling it. So it's these kinds of things. Dan heard about Change the Story. He said, I want in. How do I get involved? And what's my responsibility in this for really moving women in terms of their economic well-being and independence in this state?
So the surprising thing I'm hearing in your telling of it is that right now, over 3/4 of their STEM students at Vermont Tech are men.
That, yes.
In those programs.
Yes. In those programs, in STEM-related programs. Although the report, Change the Story report, will tell you that young women in high school start off, you know, equal to men in terms of going into a lot of the, you know, AP biology, chemistry, all of those science and math-related fields. But by the time they get to the point of, you know, employment or their career decisions, that those numbers have dropped off precipitously.
So let's burrow into some of the more surprising, and I should stop saying surprising. But when you look at data, the numbers jump out at you here. You write in this report, the poverty rate for families headed by single women is 9 times the poverty rate of married couples. And the statistic we cited at the top of the hour here, nearly half of women who work full-time don't make enough to cover basic living expenses. Tiffany Bloomley, how do you explain that? That is a desperate picture you paint there.
And it's not a lot better for men. 36% of men who work full-time don't make a livable wage. But women are a disproportionate share of those who are poor at every age, at every education level. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. One is that they are clustered in low-wage work. And we can talk about that later. But essentially, if you look at where women are employed, half are employed in jobs that pay less than $35,000. And we use $35,000 because that's the threshold that the Joint Fiscal Office has come up with, that is the amount that an individual needs to earn in order to cover basic expenses. So we're just looking at, can you even support yourself? And that is, so $35,000 is one of our markers. And if half of women are working in fields where the median annual salary is $35,000 less, it's no surprise that women, that the wage gap is what it is. But it's also a function of salaries. You walk into a job, women it's been studied, women don't negotiate their salaries. Or if they do, they are perceived to be pushy, and they may not actually get the job because of that, or they will just get immediate pushback. That's something that the Commission on Women is trying to address through a program, a partnership with Norwich College, where they are, counseling people, on young women and men, on how to negotiate a salary, because these young people are going to graduate, and that first salary that you get, it's not the determinant of what you're going to earn over the long haul, but it starts you on a path, and it's pretty hard to get significant bumps up from that in most fields. So there are also, though, hours, access to childcare. You know, there are a lot of barriers for women who have the care of minor children. And, of course, among those living in poverty, among women who are not married, they shoulder, I think they're 4 or 5 times likely to shoulder the responsibility for the care of young children. So that just complicates the picture. And it's why so many women are in part-time work. And the part-time work, if in fact women were given the choice, they would choose full-time, the women who the U.S. Census has surveyed. But they're working part-time because they're either taking care of young children or they're taking care of their elderly parents.
So one of the other facts cited here is that 40 years after Title IX, which was the law passed in 1972 that essentially mandated equal access in educational facilities, that's colleges and high schools, women's work continues to be women's work. What do you mean by that, Mary Beth?
Well, it was interesting. TIFF brought these statistics to our Change the Story committee and showed us. It was very stark, this particular one graphic of work that women did in the 1970s, typically, traditionally female-type work, nursing, teaching, home health care, bookkeeping, clerical-type work. And then she juxtaposed kind of current-day Vermont and where women are working, and there was almost no change. The numbers have almost changed. You know, they've changed incrementally in a couple of categories, but they're generally the same. That speaks to this whole issue of occupational segregation, and looking at this issue from both ends in terms of, how are we as a society really encouraging young women to pursue more, higher growth, higher paid fields that have been traditionally male. And that's a lot of the work we do at Vermont Works for Women at the upstream with young women, really trying to kind of blow the doors off their sense of what's a possible career. There's then the other end in terms of societally, what's in place that's making that happen systemically that we need to change.
This reminds me of an image. My wife was a longtime youth soccer coach in the community and talked about this moment when girls who were stronger and faster than boys when they were younger, when girls started to deliberately hold themselves back, it's all co-ed until about middle school age, mm-hmm. deliberately hold themselves back and let the boys take the ball, mm-hmm. and how she would struggle as a coach to keep the girls wanting to perform at their abilities. Tiff Bloomley, what would you say accounts for this? It sounds like you're describing the grown-up version of this in some instances.
Yeah. Well, I was a teacher. I taught history, 6th grade through 12th grade, even years. And so in 6th grade, I'd have students come in, and they would fight me, the entire period over something that they had read, and then by 10th grade, they would raise their hand very tentatively and say, I could be totally wrong, but I would think, what happened to you? You were so gutsy and so determined to be right. And this was in an all-girls school. So it wasn't to defer to the boys. It, I think, is a... The girls were learning this culturally, that to come on too strong, to assert that they knew, they were less willing to take risks. Seeing that phenomenon, I was desperate as a teacher to try to figure out how do you address this? And another teacher and I were talking about it, went to a colloquium taught by Mary Pfeiffer, who had just released her book, Reviving Ophelia. And
remind us what that book was about. It was a landmark book.
Yes, it was about girls losing their voices, essentially, in the middle school and early high school years. So we were trying to think, well, what could you do to help girls hold on to that gumption? And thus was born this idea for a program called Rosie's Girls, which then when I moved to Vermont, we were able to start at this organization that was the perfect fit. And
explain what Rosie's Girls is.
Rosie's Girls is a three-week summer. Actually, you know, Mary Beth, you should actually explain this. Sorry.
And I should just interject here. We're talking to Tiffany Bloomley, Director of Change the Story, and Mary Beth Redmond, Director of Development and Communications at Vermont Works for Women.
Well, I'm honored that you would have me speak to Rosie's Girls as really you were one of the founders of it. Rosie's Girls is a program we've been doing. We're going into our 17th year. It is a program, a girls-only program for middle school girls going into 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, really to help them develop grit, perseverance, bravery, to take healthy risks, to develop positive peer connections, all through using the skilled trades and now STEM. We've incorporated and built out STEM activities. So it's all about really blowing the doors off a girl's sense of herself and what she's capable of, and really giving her the space in a supportive space with other young women and female role models to really think about her life in the broadest of terms.
Is this a summer program or year-round?
It is. It's a summer program.
Although, so how do listeners tap into this? They're, I'm sure, making summer camp plans and such at this moment.
Absolutely. They can go to vtworksforwomen.org and register for camps. We have camps in numbers of locations. Rosie's Girls, we also have a mountain biking leadership program called Dirt Divas. So we have camp spots. If they go to our website, vtworksforwomen.org, all of the information is there. We have recently, we're excited about the coming year with Rosie's Girls. We've offered it typically in 3 weeks. We've gone to a one-week model now because so many people around the country are interested in this model for their camp programs. So we're piloting this year a one-week program where the girls are going to build Rube Goldberg machines, which is like you may have played the game Mousetrap like years ago, where the domino knocks the ball down, and they're going to use skilled trades activities and STEM related activities, math, science, engineering activities, to create these Rube Goldberg machines. And one other thing I'll add is just that we have really looked at the Agency of Education's list of transferable skills that they're really attempting to build in girls: critical thinking, clear communication, problem solving. And so we, after 16 years, said, okay, let's look at Rosie's Girls anew and figure out how we can connect to that transferable skills development that AOE is really pushing through personal learning plans with all of the 7th through 12th grade students. So I feel like this great coming together is happening of state agencies, of programs like ourselves at Vermont Works for Women, to say, how can we work together to move the needle for girls and women in this state?
So, Mary Beth, you've had different careers in journalism, working for nonprofits that have now led you to work at Vermont Works for Women. Say a little bit about your own trajectory and how it informs your work today.
Yeah. Well, I've worked really half my career journalism and the other half communicating for nonprofits that are involved in social change. Journalism I loved, and I found it frustrating because I want to make a change. I want to have a voice. And so thus my work with nonprofits like Vermont Works for Women have really allowed me to have an outlet to be a voice for people who don't have a voice. That's super important to me. I worked for 5 years in the women's correctional facility. That's actually how Tiff and I met and started working together. I saw women, Vermont women in the correctional facility, many in their 20s and 30s, who grew up trapped in this bubble of non-resources, no opportunities, no large sense of the possibilities for their lives. And so when we began collaborating, Tiff kind of reeled me in and said, you know, come to Vermont Works for Women. And their mission of helping women and girls move in their lives toward economic independence and self-sufficiency is just spot on with my priorities.
What do you see now working with, in some cases, younger women, with the Rosie's Girls, the connections? I mean, you have deep insight into incarcerated women and what led them to that place. What are the connections that you see, and how early does it start? And
The interesting thing is that the missing pieces in the lives of the women incarcerated, many of them were actually the insights garnered in the Enough Said report that Tiff referenced earlier, where we traveled around the state and talked to women about what was missing. And the things that were missing: supportive female role models, women in their lives who were pushing them forward, asking questions about their interests. Those things were missing. Peer aggression. They were noticing peer aggression. They didn't have a supportive sphere of peers to kind of collaborate with, and they noticed among the women and the mothers and adults in their lives, there was this peer aggression in existence, too.
What do you mean by that, peer aggression?
So they were, in school, they were feeling this sense of women trying to one-up one another, or putting others down, or actually, you know, nothing as overt as bullying, outright bullying, but really attempting to create spaces with other girls where girls were left out, or you know, with the instances of social media now, using social media to you know, really marginalize other girls in their sphere. So these were all things that, as well, in addition, the incarcerated women, many of them had some kind of trauma early on in their lives, come from multi-generational poverty, and thus substance abuse became kind of, for many, their road to incarceration.
Tiff Bloomley, your own background, and we just have a minute before we're going to break for the news, but what made you leave the previous careers you had as a teacher, working directly with young women, to work on issues related to women?
Well, my work at Vermont Works for Women, even though I was an administrator, we started out very, very small, and I was able to, I attended our programs, and I was exposed to the women who were in them. One of the things that was so remarkable is that we could really track our success. You know, we could see things change very quickly, and at Outward Bound, that was more organic, and it was over, I wasn't going to see these people when they had left the program, but here, what wage did she come in earning, and what wage did she end up earning when she got her job?
All right, let's pause there for the news. We're talking with Tiffany Bloomley of Change the Story, Mary Beth Redmond of Vermont Works for Women. We'll be back right after the news to talk more about women and work. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending the hour talking about the status of women and work in Vermont. Our guests are Tiffany Bloomley, Director of Change the Story Vermont, and Mary Beth Redmond, Director of Development and Communications at Vermont Works for Women. They have just released, their organizations have just released a new report called Where Vermont Women Work and Why It Matters. It's part of a four-part series. It'll ultimately be four parts by the end of the year on the status of women in work. Tiff Bloomley, earlier you mentioned your experience as a high school teacher and teaching a very interesting spread of grades in an all-girls school, 6th grade and 12th grade.
No, 6th through 12th.
6th through 12th.
8, 10, and 12, to be precise.
So you really had the aerial view of this entire kind of developmental era that we're talking about that leads to women at work today. How did you help girls find their voice?
Well, one thing I've talked about is that, you know, if a kid was really struggling in history, and this just wasn't going to be her her place to shine, but I knew she was really good at field hockey, or she was a really great singer. I'd go to her concert. I'd go to her the field hockey game, because then she would know. I saw her in an element where she felt really competent, and I think that kids need to be seen as competent, sometimes to feel competent, and they need to hear the adults in their lives express that they don't see them just in this one narrow way. And so I wasn't just her history teacher. I was an adult who really cared about the voice that she had and her ability to express and develop her talent. And that's what drew me to teaching. I loved history, but it wasn't, the reason that I became a history teacher.
Was there a moment, a vignette that you can think of where you felt like you had made a difference in the life of a girl?
Well, last month I was invited to come back down for the 20th year reunion of a particular class. These were kids that I'd taught, I think, in the 6th, 8th, and maybe 10th grades. So I'd gotten to know them very well. And they reached out and said, I know you live in Vermont. It's kind of far away from New York, but would you think about coming down? And I did. I went, because, boy, what a great opportunity to catch up with these young women, and they've got all these kids, they're doing all these things. What I learned is that some of the smallest things that you can do as a teacher make an impression, and kids will carry that with you. And it might be one conversation, or it might be showing up for the field hockey game. So I'm reminded of that when old students, get in touch with me and say, I was just remembering this thing that you did. And actually, some of the students sang back a song to me that I'd created to help them remember their Greek history. And then I thought, okay, I did one thing right.
Okay. Well, some of the things in the reports that you've had out, you've just released, include numbers that might surprise people. One of them is about women in their senior years. Can you talk about what you found out about women in their senior years?
Well, that they draw half as much Social Security as men do, $10,000.
Why is that?
Because they've earned less over time, which has a cumulative effect. So, and they've probably, they've earned less maybe because they were in and out of the workforce, but also because of the job that they held. But they also have fewer assets. And that, altogether results in, I think, incredible vulnerability for women in their senior years, particularly if they are living alone on their own. That's a problem. I think I was particularly struck by this when I thought about the projections about Vermont's population and how it will change in the next 10 years. That, in fact, 10 years from now, our elderly population will be about 25% of the state's population. Well, then what's the impact of women's precarious financial standing if they are an even bigger share of our state's people? And what kinds of pressures does that put on families? What kinds of pressures does it put on state subsidies? And that's, I'm not sure that we're doing enough as a state to make projections about those costs, but also about what we may not have in place to support the families of these elders, and elderly people themselves.
We've been talking a lot, and there is a tendency to talk about, how women, young women, may hold themselves back in certain ways. You've described how they won't negotiate for work, how they start to defer. But probably the larger thing in the economy is the institutional barriers to women advancing in the workplace. Which of you would like to discuss what are some of the institutional barriers that women face in the workplace in Vermont?
Well, there are ways in which we've set up work that make it very difficult for families to to balance both parents working and taking care of children. There are there isn't enough child care that's affordable for folks who are working. There are employers who, you know, or industries where the hours absolutely don't work for families with small children. So a woman who wants to, for example, work construction is asked often to be on a job site at 7 in the morning. Well, what child care facility is open at 7 in the morning? So apprenticeship programs are scheduled in the evenings. I think because there are more men who are single parents now, that scheduling is changing. But, you know, this doesn't have to be, it's not the natural order of things. It's how we have structured things over time. It's what we've gotten used to. Change is difficult, but this kind of change seems to me to be pretty easy to control.
Well, you're getting at the heart of Vermont culture here. I always refer to these as farmers' hours. Of course, nobody that we know who live in New York or in cities starts work at the hours that we routinely start working here, nor do our kids in school by, you know, 7 a.m. My kids are always very aggrieved when they learn that their friends from anywhere south of Vermont are showing up at school at 9 a.m. and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these kind of cultural issues, and that you point out keep people from just being able to access daycare.
Absolutely.
How do you begin to change that?
Well, I think that Let's Grow Kids and Building Bright Futures and the Permanent Fund, they're all doing their part to try to raise the visibility of the need and make a case for investing more in child care, affordable child care. I think, too, that wages have to go up. And, you know, one of the levers, I mean, because I think Change the Story is trying to look at where with some effort can you really leverage more significant change, and I think one of those levers is actually making some of the jobs that are critical to our society pay. So childcare workers are among the worst paid workers in the state, and that's nationally too. And if this is something that we value, if children are worth, if we see, let's be even really base about it, if we see the economic benefit of investing in children, then probably those salaries need to be higher. And I think we need to look at what we're valuing and how we're compensating people for the work that they're doing that is really critical. I'm personal care assistants for elders. I saw what they did for my father when he was in assisted care, and they work incredibly hard. It's critical work. We're aging. These folks need to be paid enough so that they can actually pay their bills.
So, I mean, one of the things that would obviously point to is a minimum wage, a change in the minimum wage.
Yes. I think
this is Mary Beth Redmond from Vermont Works for Women.
I think business also has a role, too. You know, I think that the one of the exciting parts of this Change the Story initiative is something that's being called the Peer Business Exchange. And it's gathering together leaders and HR folks from major employers in Vermont to kind of sit down and talk about a lot of these issues relative to their business and the operation of their business. And, you know, they're obviously interested in improving their bottom line and having greater profits. But I think that business leaders are seeing that there's a deep incentive for them to figure out, you know, how to pay their workers more, how to structure their days in different ways so that there's flexibility, you know, how to offer benefits that just have not ever been a given in the American, you know, workforce. So I'm very encouraged by that. Beth Sachs at VEIC is leading that conversation. And And, you know, there are representatives from really, you know, big employers in Vermont starting to have these conversations. How do we, as corporations, write our job descriptions differently so that we attract more women, you know, and use the word digital for a job, which a woman responds more to than the word technology? Little subtle things like that need to happen from the business community as well.
Because it's in the business's best interest. I mean, study after study has shown that, in fact, the more diverse a board is, the higher companies' profits. They do better by 26% when the boards are more diverse. And I think that stands. It's same thing for teams. If teams are more diverse.
Well, back up a second. Companies that have women on their boards do better. Do 26% better? Is that what?
Yeah. There's a kind of a critical mass. I believe it's like at least three women on their boards.
So you have a lot of small businesses in Vermont, many of them trying to do the right thing. If you were starting a business, or if you were handed the keys to one of those businesses, Tiff Bloomley, what would be some of the first things you would be sure were in place for workers?
For workers, I think you'd want to make sure that your decision-making teams were diverse, because you need a lot of different perspectives at the table to come up with the most innovative ideas. And I would want to take opportunities to try to think about flexible working hours. What can work for families? I'd want to pay a bottom rate that is a livable wage. And these are all tall order, right, for small businesses and large, yet we cannot continue. The income inequality is such a critical problem now. Too many aren't able to make ends meet when they're working at least 40 hours a week. That's not sustainable. And it has tremendous repercussions, as Robert Putnam and all kinds of economists have now said. This trend. So I think there are structural issues that we need to confront as a legislature, as our next governor, and as business leaders, to figure out how are we going to make our communities healthier so that people have money in their pockets so they can buy the things that businesses want them to buy, so they can send their kids to college, which we know is a ticket to a better job for many, and engage the best talent that we have in our midst to solve some of the problems that we face, because we have a lot. There are a lot of them, and we need to make the most of every single drop of talent in this state. And we're leaving some of it on the table.
So what are the most effective ways to change the story? Mary Beth?
Well, I definitely, I would speak from a programmatic standpoint, because that's what we do, is really to meet, is to plant the seeds of these concepts at a young age, with women, in terms of really reaching far and wide, giving them exposure to the broad range of career possibilities. One of the things we do at a big STEM and trades conference we host at Vermont Tech every year is we give young women a little doll, like a fake dollar bill, that shows if you go into this industry, this is what you'll start off at. This is what you have the capacity to make over your career life. And we really, put in their hands tangible information about, their career trajectory, income-wise, related to this. So it's starting upstream more. We used to talk about this work at the high school level. Now we're talking middle school and even before that. I have a 13-year-old son, and we're constantly talking about, like, what are your interests? What do you know that you could make this much as an architect? Here's, let's go and shadow an architect for a day. Those kinds of conversations, I think, is upstream, one of the key things that we need to be doing.
Is that dollar bill with the is that available online? That's a very useful device.
You know, it's not, but we can certainly put it online. We have it for all different career occupations. And the other organization I really need to give a shout out to, because they've been doing this work, is the McClure Foundation. The McClure Foundation has been doing amazing work in terms of identifying high growth, high wage occupations in Vermont. And they have like a fourfold brochure that literally details, if you go into these fields, this is how much education you need, this is what you will make over your lifetime. And that handout is definitely online. And I can, you know, it would be the McClure Foundation online. We can definitely connect you up with that brochure.
Okay, and I'm seeing it's McClureVT.org, McClureVT.org. Tiff?
Can I take a shot at answering that question, building on what Mary Beth said? I think part of what Change the Story is trying to do is acknowledge that gender matters. I think that there has, certainly when I was at Vermont Works for Women, I constantly had to explain why we even existed. And now we have data to demonstrate that we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't solved some of the problems, like women's disproportionate share of poverty. So I think that one of the ways we change the story is to collect the data. Now, I don't think private philanthropy should be footing the bill for this data collection over the long haul. It has this last year. But I think that we're going to encourage state agencies to regularly, as routine state practice, collect some of the data that we collected on our own and then get it out there and make it part of the data that paints a picture of how well Vermont is doing, how well its citizens are doing. We don't always disaggregate data by gender, but that matters. I also think each one of us, you and I and Mary Beth as parents, but as teachers, as people with talk shows, as legislators, there is something that each one of us can do to raise awareness and to change the story. Maybe it's by asking that kid down the street, what are you going to do this summer? And have you ever thought of, or making a call for them to somebody where you think maybe they could get an internship and that might open their eyes to a whole other field that they would never have considered. I think we each have an individual roles to play. I think finally, though, we need to be able to leverage the institutions in our communities that have the greatest influence. And I think that's K-12 education. I think that's higher ed. And I think it's the business community, as Mary Beth was saying. I think that those institutions and some of their trade organizations have a role to play in also looking at this data and evaluating how well they're doing. And are we making progress? If this is one additional lens, we're not saying this is the only problem. We're not saying that boys don't have their challenges at all. What we are saying is that this is a set of issues that we need to address, and that that merit attention, as do, you know, X, Y, and Z.
So you have spent, Tiff, several decades working on these issues.
Why haven't we moved the needle?
How will you know that you have changed the story? What would be an indication to you?
Well, if women's disproportionate poverty rate were to change, if we could get more women into engineering and computer science, if we saw that change, if businesses were very conscious, if I heard businesses talking and saw on their conference schedules workshops on how to support women in the workplace, or how to restructure hours that would be supportive of families, I think that that's I want to hear the conversation. We're really lucky right now that I think we're living in a time when the pressures on families are so great that all of a sudden people are talking about issues that they would not talk about 10 years ago, which is raising the minimum wage, paid family leave, paid sick days, etc. Nobody talked about those things until really the last 5 years or so, and it's been mostly in the last couple of years, and this presidential campaign has brought it up. These aren't women's issues. These are family issues, and they're state issues. I mean, it's all about the health of our communities. So I think there probably are a number of things that we would see change. I've named a few of them, but it is going to take all of us. It's a different kind of awareness. It's an additional awareness, and it's a willingness to be curious about why some things are so.
Okay, well, let's, in the minute or two we have left, we have a caller on the line. Terry is calling from Moncton. Terry, what's your question today?
Well, I wonder what role your different organizations have for men. Women, you made the comment, this is not women's issues, it's community and family, et cetera, which I absolutely agree with, but you seldom have men in the role of the organization. I just wonder what openings or what you have in the way of roles for men.
Okay, Mary Beth Redmond.
We welcome men. I mean, we can't do this without. Men are our allies. They are our collaborators. We welcome men volunteers at our various organizations. And it's fathers really understanding these in the raising of their children, their daughters as well as their sons, and really, taking a leadership role in putting a stake in the ground related. The interesting thing is that the men that I connect with most are the men who say, wow, I have two daughters, and I am very much worried about these trends related to my daughters. And so it opens up a lot of awareness relative to what do I need to do? How do I get involved? I would say, what's your area of interest? How do you want to participate? We are, increase the number of women. If you run a company, a nonprofit, increase the number of women on your boards and advisory councils. I'll let Tiff jump in, too.
Okay, and we just have about 30 seconds left here.
Fine. I only have 30 seconds to say. Change of Story has deliberately engaged men in our conversations. They serve as our advisors. They've reviewed our data. We've also, though, they have asserted their own role in this work. So Dan Smith at Vermont Technical College, he's been spearheading this initiative. We have several men who are part of the Business Peer Exchange. Joe Fusco was just featured on another radio show where he talked about the importance of this and the importance of men coming to the fore and saying, this is important, it affects all of us.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. People can get more, can see these reports and get more info at vtworksforwomen.org and changethestoryvt.org. And I want to thank both of you, Tiffany Bloomley from Change the Story and Mary Beth Redmond from Vermont Works for Women, for joining us on the Vermont Conversation this week.
Thanks for having us.
That does it for our show this week. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1. And also go to VBSR.org to learn about the upcoming spring conference that happens on May 12th. Thanks.
This previous hour has been presented by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, featuring interviews with leading change makers from around Vermont and around the world. It's underwritten by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, The Heart and Science of Medicine by Vermont National Life Group, which lives its values every day. Do good, be good, make good. By Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power, as well as over 750 VBSR businesses.
You're listening to locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie and AM 550, WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. We're serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond. It's 2 o'clock.
Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire, the last.